Test Talks, episode 13. Hit it.
Welcome to the Test Talks podcast, the place to go to geek out on software testing. And now your host, whose mission is to help you succeed with test automation, Joe Colantonio.
Hello, 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 and welcome to another episode of Test Talks, a podcast dedicated to all things test automation. I'm your host, Joe, from joecolantonio.com, and this is a podcast that I like to say is automation awesomeness for your earbuds. And today we're going to be talking with Corey House on how to create awesome, clean test automation code. So as test engineers, how often do we proclaim that test automation code is real code and it should be treated like any other development project? You know, I say it all the time. And so since test automation code is development code, it should adhere to the same standards like code reviews and like, just like any other development effort. Now, for example, I'm currently an automation BDD lead for a large company, and I created a test automation framework developed in Java using Selenium and behavior-driven development. Because of this, I'm involved in all the code reviews of the BDD test automation code. So as you can imagine, this can be a daunting task. So one thing that really helped me tremendously in being able to help other people while I was doing code reviews, to give them really good advice, to really find out the problem areas and to know where the red flags are for areas that possibly could be optimized or refactored, was watching a Pluralsight course by Corey House called Clean Code, Writing Code for Humans. This is a great course. The course lasts about 3 hours, and Corey covers all the key concepts that you need to know on how to create clean, readable code. And so it's geared towards developers, but the same principles, because usually when you're writing Selenium, you're writing in an actual programming language, you should be following the same exact principles that Corey lays out in this course. So if you are not familiar with Pluralsight, I would head on over to the site. I think it's like $29 a month for unlimited access to all their video trainings. And everyone I've taken, any of the authors have been really good. And this one really, like I said, really helped me a lot to become a better code reviewer and to write better code, more clean code, code that really can be read. So if you're into writing clean test automation code or any type of code that is readable and that is maintainable, then this episode is for you. So check it out as we speak with Corey about how to write clean test automation code. I'm really excited today to be speaking with Corey House, the founder of BitNative, a software agile development and training consultancy, and the creator of OutlierDeveloper.com, which is a really cool community for software developers who aspire to be exceptional. He's a Pluralsight author, a conference speaker, an independent consultant, and a blogger with 15 years experience as a full-stack software developer. Corey is the author of one of my new favorite Pluralsight courses, Clean Code, Writing Code for Humans. And today we're going to be speaking about the course and how we can use those principles that Corey lays out step by step on how to create clean test automation code. Hey, Corey, welcome to Test Talks.
Hi, Joe. How you doing?
Great. So, Corey, before we get started, can you just tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Yeah, sure. So I've been writing software for about 15 years now, primarily web applications throughout my career. Worked at some Fortune 500 companies, some small businesses along the way. Currently work for a subsidiary of AutoTrader called Vin Solutions, where I really focus on building single-page applications for the automotive industry and have a lot of fun there. End up getting to do kind of full-stack work. And I'm a big car guy, so that's a lot of fun for me.
In a nutshell, can you tell us a little bit about what is clean code and why I should care?
That's a great question. So clean code, there's a lot of reasons that it matters. And I think maybe one of the biggest reasons is that writing code is a lot easier than reading code. And I'm sure you're someone that's experienced the same problem where you end up writing your code and you end up getting it to work, but you look back on it later and you realize, you know, if I ever had to maintain that or understand it later, my intent isn't very clear, or I'd end up having to maintain two or three different places because I repeated myself. Really, clean code should look about like you'd expect it to. It should be as clear as possible with your intent. And that's the really core problem with test code in particular, because when a test fails, I really need to understand not just that I got this red, but that there's a specific intent that I was looking for that didn't end up happening.
So are there any core principles for writing clean code?
One of the core principles, of course, is just consistency. And I just recently, I was in Oslo and saw a talk that was really a roundabouts about clean code. And one of the points that it made that I thought was really interesting was this idea of beauty. And the presenter showed a number of different faces and then asked people which face they thought was most beautiful. And what was interesting was the room felt that the face that was least remarkable was the most beautiful. The face, and what was interesting about that was that that face was the very one that was really a conglomeration of all those other faces. So it ended up having nothing that particularly stood out. It was consistent. It was a middle of the line. And that ultimately, clean code should not have any areas where you look at this test, for instance, and say, this just doesn't look like the others. It doesn't follow the naming structure that we had before. It doesn't follow the arrange, act, assert pattern. Whatever it may be that you're doing in some of your tests should be something that you use as a common structure throughout, because just like when you're reading a book, you think about how this book has chapters and it has headings, and that helps me get through the book and understand what the author's getting to. And the more that we follow these common conventions, the easier it is to read that code and understand the intent of the developer.
Excellent. Yeah, I totally agree. Especially with my team, we have a lot of offshore resources. So it gets really difficult if people are using different styles. So even like you said, having consistent style across teams makes a huge difference. So that's a great tip. So along the same lines, you brought up this book concept. In your training, you also brought this up about how to name classes and variable names. So are there any best practices we can do to create clean code by naming our variables or classes?
Yeah, that's a large topic. And the thing is, a lot of these same principles for writing code apply to tests again. And one thing that I've found is there's a lot of places where I'm struggling with conveying my intent. And what I really needed to do was just introduce an intermediate variable. A variable that says, when I'm writing this conditional, my intent is this. And often that can end up being a Boolean, where I ended up creating a complex conditional with 3, 4, 5 different checks in it. And if I ended up using an intermediate variable or perhaps refactoring that little section over to a separate method, then all of a sudden my intent is clear because I have, rather than using a comment to sort of shim in the code and make it stronger, I can end up using the code to express myself better. And that's exactly what an intermediate variable or refactoring to a method does, because now the code is totally conveying that intent clearly. And that's one of the easiest ways to go. There's also cases where you, of course, everybody's seen the 2,000 line class that ends up doing all these different things. And we can make these very same mistakes in our test code and end up trying to test too much at once. And of course, there's a lot of different patterns that can get you there, whether you're someone into the BDD camp, for instance. And I think that some of the benefit of those ideas is giving people a clear structure to follow. Because when you're getting started in testing, one of the biggest struggles is, boy, it seems like everybody has their own opinion on how to do it right. And if I just do really anything consistently, it's a lot easier to shift in a new direction later.
Also, I think a big point is the readability. And the example you gave, once again, was a return. You have an example of normally it was frowned upon to have multiple return statements within a method, but you showed an example of how multiple return statements, it can become more readable, and that maybe readability might be the key factor that we look for when writing clean code.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was an idea that I'd taken from Steve McConnell long ago in his book, Code Complete. And it was a revelation to me because I remember learning that pretty early on that there should be one return statement per method. That was something that I was taught in school. Only to find later that that whole idea had really gone out of vogue, because the revelation that he had was you can end up writing more code if you don't return early. I find methods that return early easier to understand because it really helps mimic life. And I think about if I have a method, for instance, that is called, let's say, mail, send email to user. And if the very first check ends up checking and saying, well, this person isn't even a registered user, then throw an exception or return, whatever the semantics makes sense at that point, then the beauty of it is I know down below that I have all the necessary preconditions to be able to do the body of my method. It's a bit like the idea of coding by contract. I have this contract at the top of my method that's saying, here's the 2, 3, 4 different things that I expect to be true before I end up doing the meat of this method. And that really takes the weight off of the reader. And you can imagine if you come in and you're trying to debug that specific piece, you can say, okay, well, I know that the author intended these things to be in a certain state, and they've clarified that by putting these preconditions at the top of the method. And that's just really helpful to have those guard clauses at the beginning.
Awesome. And this brings up another point you brought up in your course, Clean Code, about placeholder variables. And also it reminded me of another best practice I was taught early in my career, but you really shined a light on it that may not be the best practice, of declaring all your variables at the top of a method or function. I think you made a really great point of when you do this, it makes it harder to read. You have to keep scanning the top to see what this variable is. And so you should call that variable as close to when you actually use it within the method. I thought that was a great tip also that you shared.
Thanks. Yeah, and I call that the mayfly variable principle. Yes. Because it's this idea of, if you're familiar with mayflies, they're an animal with one of the shortest lifespans in the world. So it helps you remember it. A mayfly may live no more than about 24 hours. So we want to feel that same way about our variables, that we instantiate them as late as we can and then bring them out of scope as soon as we can, because the human mind can only hold about 7 items in short-term memory at once. So if we can keep that number as low as possible, we'll make our code a lot easier to read. And the way that we do that, of course, is keeping our variables, instantiating them as late as possible. And this is one of the problems that you run into with really long methods, is you'll find people will end up instantiating a variable way at the top, and then the reader has to keep track of that variable for potentially dozens, if not hundreds of lines, if it's a particularly long method. And that taxes the reader and makes them more likely to make a mistake. When we read the code, we're basically pretending we're compilers. We're running the application in our heads, right? So it's really easy to get tripped up when we're trying to juggle too many variables at once. And that's one of the big benefits of small, well-named methods anyway. I will say the one caveat that I didn't mention in my course, I wish I would have, is the exception to this rule is if you happen to be working in JavaScript, because of this fun thing called hoisting, where your variables are effectively moved to the top of the function. And you don't see that. That's just what happens behind the scenes. So effectively, in JavaScript, all of your variables are always declared at the beginning of your function anyway. So you might as well do that there, just so that the reader understands how your code will actually execute.
To me, it seems like the principles you presented here apply to pretty much all programming languages. I develop in Java, and your examples were in, I believe, C#, .NET. So they still apply, though, and it seems like these principles apply 10 years ago and probably 10 years into the future. So it's a timeless course.
I certainly hope so. I enjoy the timeless courses. It's fun to put something together like that where you feel like you're getting those foundational principles that'll continue to apply.
But as I say this now, though, we do Java AngularJS development, and I'm not familiar enough to know if it applies to JavaScript, like this example you brought up, how that's slightly different. But I would assume clean code is clean code regardless.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting that some of the principles that I've described, I've had people come up who are familiar with functional languages, and functional languages aren't my forte, but they feel like some of the principles that I described that help deal with things like mutable state are solved through these functional paradigms where you have immutable structures. And that's an interesting idea. And I'd love to go back through this course later with a more functional mindset and think about what functional clean code looks like versus a traditional object-oriented programmer's mindset. But I'm certainly not the man to describe those sorts of things the best.
Along the same lines of naming your variables and your method names so they're readable, you have a great section about comments. And here's another thing that you sometimes see. You think someone's being thorough, they have these lines and lines of comment. And it's almost like you said, if they name their things correctly, make their variable names readable, their class names readable, it almost comments itself. So it takes care of a lot of those extra things you feel like you need to comment, because you're naming what you're naming things is the comment.
Absolutely. And that's one of the fun things that I've learned in interviewing programmers. I've had the experience of interviewing people for a lot of years now. And it's one of the questions that I always ask is, how do you write code that is clean and maintainable by others? The interesting takeaway is a large portion of people will say, I write a lot of comments. And I'll say, okay, what else do you do? And it's surprising how often that people stumble to come up with some other answers. Usually I'll get, well, I'll name my variables well, and then you start to run out of ideas at that point. And that's not a great sign, because there's all these other ways to help manage complexity and keep our code clean. And I see comments as a necessary piece, but they're something that you should use as a last resort. If there's a way that you can convey your intent in the code, then that's preferable. And it's preferable for a lot of reasons. For one thing, the code is going to stay maintained. And if someone refactors it, they will refactor your code, and they're highly likely to end up renaming any variables or methods that have been impacted by that refactoring. The comments, on the other hand, are often overlooked and can end up lying to you and even hurting the clarity of the code. There's a lot of instances where I've found when I start hitting whack, whack, put in such and such comment, I start asking myself, is there any way that I could avoid this comment? Could I put in an intermediate variable? Could I refactor to a method? Have I really not found the cleanest algorithm to be able to solve this problem? When you think about things that way, you'll find that you very rarely need to insert comments to make sure that someone understands your code.
I really love this section on comments. Unfortunately, we use a tool called CheckStyle, and we have to use a corporate CheckStyle kind of template that looks over your classes and says, hey, you're missing a comment, you're missing a comment. And its intent is to create better code quality, but actually when you look at the comments, they're just, some people just add a comment and they basically just give it the name of the variable or the method that they added, and there's really no value added. Even though it's trying to enforce good practices, it almost makes it harder to do.
So are you saying it even enforces it at the variable level?
It'll force the naming convention of a variable. You need to use camel case. If it doesn't find it, it'll flag it. It won't let you check into CI if you have so many exceptions.
Gotcha. Yeah, it sounds very similar to StyleCop that you see in C Sharp.
Yes. Yep.
Okay. Yeah, and then there's also GhostDoc, which some people like to use on the .NET side, which ends up slapping comments in for you. And I'm not a big fan of that, because what it's doing is trying to programmatically add in comments, but all it can do is take the code that it sees and try to generate a comment, and it's highly unlikely to add any new information. It's just repeating your name as a comment. To me, I feel like a comment that repeats the name of your method is breaking the don't repeat yourself principle, that there should be one place for that data. And if your method is well named, then hopefully you don't need a comment saying what it does. If your method is called get user by ID, it's pretty obvious what it's doing in that case, looking at the signature combined with the name. So having a comment that says whack whack get user by ID is just repeating yourself, yeah, right?
Absolutely.
It's another thing to maintain, and it's another few lines on your screen that isn't code. It's more or less noise.
Absolutely. And you also have a good example of, make sure when you're adding a comment, it really is adding value and that it is really being helpful. It's not just a placeholder for something that you should be doing.
Exactly. Yeah. Ask yourself, is there any way that I could avoid writing this? Is there another way to state myself in code instead?
Corey, you briefly mentioned the DRY principle. What is the DRY principle?
The DRY principle stands for don't repeat yourself. And I believe this was coined in the book, The Pragmatic Programmer. And it really speaks to that principle of every piece of knowledge should exist in one place. And if you think in terms of relational databases, for instance, and how we normalize the database so that we don't end up repeating ourselves all over in different tables, that same sort of idea makes sense in code as well. Because when we change a bug in one spot, we want to make sure that that one bug fix impacted all the different places that might use that piece of business logic. And you also want to think about your code base as something that you optimize to be as small as possible. I think Bill Gates has a great quote where he talked about how measuring the quality of a code base by lines of code is a bit like measuring the quality of a airliner by weight. So I think I butchered his quote pretty bad, but that core idea of trying to get your code base as small as possible. And you do that by not repeating yourself. And that rule applies just as much to tests as anywhere else. If you need to refactor out an arrange section to some kind of a helper class, then that can be really useful so that all these different test methods can end up leveraging that same piece of code.
This brings me to, I guess it's a larger question. I'm not expecting you to know the answer to this, but how can we create more of a culture of people that like writing clean code? I don't know if that makes sense, but I'm surprised. I work with a lot of test QA resources, and I understand how when they write code for the first time, they may be unaware of some of these principles, but also because we're doing BDD, we have real developers that are actually writing the application, writing automation code, and their code is kind of the same thing. It's not as clean as I thought it would be. They don't understand some of these principles. So I guess my question is, how do you create a culture of clean code?
That's a great question. So, I mean, one thing that I did right away was after I'd read these books and I realized the mistakes I was making, I start leading by example in my code base. And hopefully you're in an organization where you're doing code reviews, right? So people are seeing your code. And as people see your code and you explain some of the things that you did and why, hopefully they learn by example and go, yeah, okay, that code review was easy for me. I really understood the intent. I'm going to take some of those practices and put them to use in my own code. Another thing that anybody can do is go out, schedule a lunch and learn at their office, and start to convey these same ideas. If this is something that resonates with you and you want to see your team get on board, we don't need to look to our bosses to get the permission to even do a lunch and learn about these sorts of things. If they don't want to buy the pizza, I highly recommend spend a little money and just get people in. And this is really just an opportunity for anybody to go, hey, here's some things that I've learned and I'd really like to share them with others and help improve our code base. And I mean, I'll say that I do it for selfish reasons, because ultimately the cleaner that our code base is, the easier my job is, the easier everyone's job is. So if you want to stay at a company long-term, you want to make sure that the easy things continue to be easy.
Absolutely. So I'm in a weird position. I actually have to do all the code reviews for the test automation code before it gets promoted. So it's almost like I become like a bad cop. It's not really the role I want to be in. I want to encourage people. So
sure,
it's a tough one to get over.
Yeah, I've been there too. I think that's always the balancing act in a code review, is you don't want to be nitpicky, and you have to be clear about what's in scope and what isn't. Are we looking for logic errors? Are we looking for style issues? And setting up some of those ground rules can help. I think it's tough enforcing, you know, basic clean coding practices in a code review without people feeling a little bit frustrated or offended. Like you're focusing too much on the style. I mean, there's certainly a balance there. And that's where I prefer trying to get people on board with a lunch and learn first, and then perhaps one-on-one doing pair programming. At the point when you're writing code going, okay, I see what we're doing here, but maybe we could go in a different direction and we have this other way that we could do it that is more expressive, that better clarifies our intent. You're a lot less likely to offend someone when we make those suggestions real time, because we're both just trying to solve the problem together.
Yeah, that's a great tip also. Peer review. Just because we're testers, you're writing automation code, you're developing Java, you should still be able to do pair programming. So that's a great idea.
Mm-hmm. You know, that is an interesting point. I do pair programming, but I can't say I've done pair programming very often when I'm writing tests. And that's a great place to really get people on board. I think part of that is because there's probably, like a lot of shops, there's some people that end up writing test-driven code and others that just don't, either because they prefer to write test after or they just don't write automated tests at all, whatever it may be. So there's this schism between the two groups. And I come to think of it, it's a real opportunity. If you know people in the office that aren't into testing, inviting them over when you're writing your automated tests so that you don't have to do that with a mindset of, hey, let me teach you something. It can be a, hey, can we collaborate on this? Because I'm having a hard time getting this stuff under test, and maybe we'll learn a little bit from each other, so that it comes across as two peers that are just trying to get better and solve these problems together.
Absolutely. Is there just one clean code principle someone could choose which would have the most immediate impact on their code quality?
I think if there were one overarching rule that would help improve someone's code quality, it would be thinking about how to write self-documenting code. Imagine that no one can come and speak to you again. Imagine that people can't read any of your comments, and imagine that there's no documentation that they can go lean on to find out what you're wanting to do. So all they have to read is your literal code, the code that is read by the compiler. And if you can convey your intent very clearly through just the code, then you're writing self-documenting code. You don't need any of those other things that I talked about. And to get there, that's really the foundation, because to get there, you're going to have to do all the other things that really come into clean code. That is the foundational reason that we want to do this, is so that the code is self-documenting, because our goal here is to write code that humans can understand and can parse, right? The computers really don't care about any of this stylistic sort of stuff, and they don't care about a 1,000-line method or a poorly named variable. So that I think is at the heart of it. The way that you get there to having self-documenting code is really thinking about the signal to the noise ratio in your code. How can I improve the signal and remove a lot of the noise? So I want people to see exactly what I'm trying to do, hopefully in as little code as possible, being expressive but also terse. So how can I express my intent really well without adding a whole lot of lines of code? That's where, in the course, I spend a lot of time talking about metaphors, where I compare writing software to writing a book, right? And a lot of these same principles apply here, of good authors are breaking down their ideas into smaller pieces using chapters and using headings and using paragraphs. And we have all those same tools at our disposal, but now we think in terms of, you know, namespaces and methods and variables and classes, those sorts of things. Those are all our different boxes to put things in. And those boxes are, yes, they're useful for the compiler, but they're also really useful for us as humans to slot these things into our head in smaller pieces.
I think you actually start off the course with some really good quotes that summarize this. Of course, I don't have them available, but I'll do an edit and I'll add the quotes. But, you know, you really want to make code readable for humans, not for computers.
Yeah, the inspiration for the course was a quote by Martin Fowler that said, any fool can write code that a computer can understand. Good programmers write code that humans can understand. And I love that idea. And then a friend of mine, Steve Bolin, had a quote that hit me too, where he said, there's no problem so simple that a bad developer can't make it complicated. And I've seen that where you go, okay, this is a contact form and we just got to add a field. Let me go in there. And then you look at it and you go, what am I even looking at? This is not at all what I expected to see. And that's, I love that idea. I think it may have been Ward Cunningham that said that clean code looks pretty much like you would expect it. And that's where, yeah, okay, I'm looking at this simple contact form. I look at the code behind the scenes and I go, yep, that's pretty much exactly what I thought it would look like. Somebody wrote clean code. But we often run across these big chunks of code and go, wow, that is a bizarre solution that really doesn't look at all like what I expected it to.
And so when you find those issues, which are inevitable, this goes to refactoring. How do you know when to refactor?
Well, there's a lot of cues for refactoring. One very simple step is when I find myself struggling with the complexity of my code, when I find that I'm getting confused, then obviously any other reader is really going to be in trouble because nobody knows this code better than I do. And at this moment in time, I have this code loaded into my short-term memory. So if walking through it with all of the business logic in my head, all the requirements available to me, it's still not quite clear how this is flowing through, that's a huge red flag. It's such a problem because it is the very essence of malpractice if I'm concerned that I won't even be able to understand what I did a month or two later. So that's a real obvious red flag. I think also when you look at sort of these basic ideas for setting principles on clean code, and this is something that Uncle Bob outlines in his book, Clean Code, where he says, you know, a method should never be over 100 lines and should rarely be over 20 lines. And I remember seeing some of those rules and thinking that they sounded really extreme and it sounded like dogma to me. I've come to realize that that really has dramatically improved the readability of my code moving in that direction, because you are much more expressive when you break things down into smaller pieces. And it's also often easier to test in smaller pieces. When you think in terms of unit testing, what is the unit to you? And that's a gray area that everybody struggles with, right? I find it a lot easier to exercise the code when it is smaller units of work.
So I agree. Is it just sometimes for some reason I also get resistance for refactoring? I think refactoring is a good thing. And it's just making something good even better. But for some reason, sometimes it gets a bad rap for some reason.
Well, I think in those cases where refactoring gets a bad rap is, hey, here's this big class that everybody knows is ugly, and it's okay, it's 2,500 lines of code, and none of these methods really relate to each other. It's low on cohesion. It's not well named. But you know what? Looking in source control, we haven't touched this in 2 years. It just works. So what is my motivation to go in there and clean it up? There's a balancing act that goes on here. You know, Uncle Bob talks about the Boy Scout rule and leaving the code a little better than you found it. And I really do like that idea. If I'm in the code touching a given method, then yes, I might clean that up a little. But I'm not going to go into this other area of the code that has been humming along for a long period and refactor it just for the sake of readability, because you may never have another reader. I mean, you think about your code like a library, and if this section of the code is effectively a book that no one's checked out for 2 years, then why do we care about the readability? Yes, it'd be nice if it were more readable, but if it's not, especially if it's not under test, then why would we go refactoring it? And even with existing tests, it's hard to justify refactoring them because you may end up somehow regressing those tests. That's a tough balancing act there. Now, if I found myself rebuilding the very features that test were working with, then yeah, I'd probably feel a lot more comfortable refactoring any tests that I felt like needed some attention.
Are there any resources or books you would recommend to help someone to learn programming or creating clean code?
The number one book that I'd recommend is Code Complete by Steve McConnell. Really fun read. Steve has a knack for writing a technical book that reads almost like a novel. It's just a lot of fun. I remember reading it front to back and just being excited each day to go home and knock out another chapter. Another one of my big favorites is by Uncle Bob Martin, the book Clean Code, and just a wonderful book. And he has some really unique ideas at the beginning, talking with a number of different well-known developers about what clean code is to them. And a lot of their insights really helped change the way that I thought about the way that I write code. What I like about what Uncle Bob does in his book is clarifying really clearly what he thinks clean code is and isn't. Rather than speaking in generalities, he's really specific about it. Like I'd talked about saying, hey, a method shouldn't be longer than this, or hey, avoid switching parameters, for instance. There's these really clear rules, and he's good at explaining exactly why he sets these rules. And then, of course, I'm going to mention my course as well on Pluralsight. If you happen to have a subscription, it's called Clean Code, Writing Code for Humans. My course takes a little different tact and thinks about writing code from the perspective of an author, and selling you on the fact that you are an author, and that has big implications. And I really cover three core ways that we can increase the quality of our code, which is maximizing the signal-to-noise ratio and choosing the right tool for the job, and then finally striving to write self-documenting code.
Awesome. Great resources. And definitely agree with you that your course was very excellent. You also have another one that I enjoyed. I watched it yesterday. I had a 12-hour ride from West Virginia, and I was riding kind of shotgun with you using the Pluralsight app, but Becoming an Outlier. Reprogramming the developer mind. I enjoyed that. That was really, really cool too.
Yeah, that's a favorite of mine. I get to do my first keynote next month at CodeStock with that one. It's been so much fun to present in person too, and I was really excited to get it out on Pluralsight. There's just been so many different responses to it. It's great getting feedback from people.
What does a rubber duck have to do with clean code? I work remotely, so this one really helped me a lot.
Yeah, it does. And I use rubber duck because I believe Jeff Atwood was the one who originally threw out this idea of talking to a rubber duck. And you've probably had this situation where you're sitting at your desk and you're having a really hard time naming a variable or coming up with a solution to a bug. And you throw up your hands and you walk over to your neighbor's desk and you say, hey, so I've got this problem, and you start to explain it. And then you go, oh, never mind. And you walk away because you realize verbalizing your problem, describing it to someone else, helped you exercise a different part of your brain and think about the problem differently. And I'm someone that works from home a lot as well. And I found that talking with someone else can be really useful. Now, sometimes I'm home all alone and I will just walk over to the window and I will pretend that I am presenting my problem to a room of people and saying, okay, here's the problem set. Let me show you what's going on here. I'll draw up on the whiteboard, whatever it may be. And I am thinking about that problem very, very differently by using a different part of my brain, by interacting with it in this more novel way of just staring at the screen, hoping that the idea will come to me.
I don't have a rubber duck. I have a robot tissue box thing. So that's who
that's
I talk
unique.
To. Yeah.
So, it makes for a great mental picture. You're talking to lots of Kleenex.
Exactly. Yeah. I'll include that in the show notes for everyone to see. Okay, Corey, before we go, what is the one piece of actionable advice you can give someone trying to improve their code efforts? And let us know the best way to find or contact you.
My one piece of advice is to write your code with the reader in mind. Don't write your code for a computer. Write your code for your coworkers. And as far as ways to find me, I have a blog on bitnative.com. I also have a community for developers who are trying to build exceptional careers that I just spun up about a month and a half ago called outlierdeveloper.com. And there's a lot of blog posts out there for anybody that's just looking to create an exceptional career in software development. I'm also on Twitter at HouseCore. And of course, you can find my courses out on Pluralsight.
Awesome. Thanks, Corey. This has been really helpful, and I really appreciate your time.
Thanks a lot, Joe.
If you like what you hear on Test Talks, head on over to testtalks.com and click on the subscribe and iTunes icon. Leave, hopefully, a 5-star review, and I will give you a personal shout out at the beginning of an upcoming episode. Thank you for joining me on Test Talks. And remember, you can find the links to everything of value that we talked about today in the show notes at www.testtalks.com/13. And as always, test everything and keep the good. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Test Talks podcast. Head on over to www.testtalks.com for full show notes, amazing blog articles, and other automation awesomeness.